Good afternoon. And everyone can hear okay? It's working fine? My name is Eddie Powers. I'm one of the lecturers here at the Museum of Modern Art, and I'd like to welcome you to another in the Education Department series of brown bag lectures that we do. The talk I'd want to do today is focusing on Salvador Dali, and in particular, it's in anticipation of the Salvador Dali show that we're going to have coming to the museum in late June, June 29th, I believe, and running through the rest of the summer. And for Salvador Dali, one of the things that's interesting about the show, because it also functions somewhat as a retrospective exhibition, there are a number of works from throughout his career that will be accessible in the course of the exhibition, but also to see his continuous involvement with film, which, for those of you who maybe don't know Dali all that well, it perhaps comes as somewhat of a surprise, because although he had this lifelong commitment to film, actually very few of them were ultimately realized in any concrete form. I'd want to focus on probably one of the most famous, and certainly the earliest, Ancien Andalou, An Andalusian Dog. What I'd want to do is just give a brief introduction to the film, then we'll actually watch it. It's very short, it's about 17 or 18 minutes, and then to discuss the relationship of a number of the major images and themes that you have within the film to Salvador Dali's works, his painted works in particular. The film is interesting, too, because it actually came to fruition in a really condensed time frame, essentially in relation to Dali's involvement with it, because, of course, the film was co-made with Luis Buñuel. They got together in January of 1929 at Dali's home, and they had hashed out a scenario between the two of them, and essentially the fundamental rule of coming to a scenario for the film was that none of the images that they use have any sort of concrete or simple symbolism or explanation, that anything that seemed too transparent in terms of what its meanings might be was something that was automatically rejected from the film. It's an interesting idea in relation to surrealism, because surrealism so emphasized something called automatism, the notion of working spontaneously, improvisationally, and freely. And that was essentially the defining characteristic of surrealism when it first started back in 1924. So the idea of kind of having this process of hashing out ideas, rejecting them, or accepting them on the spur of the moment, it has a good sort of lineage going back to surrealism. So they came up with a scenario. The filming actually took place in two venues in April of 1929 at Billancourt Studios in Paris. And there's also what looks like it's going to be a kind of lovely Hollywood, sunset scene on the beach, but doesn't quite turn out that way, that they shot in Le Havre. And like a lot of great filmmakers with their early films, this one was also funded by the filmmaker's parents. Buñuel's mom was the one who coughed up a fair bit of the money in order to be able to produce it. As the story goes, supposedly, his leverage was that my sisters have their dowries, I want to have my film. One of the things that's interesting, it premiered in June of 1929, so you're talking about a six-month time frame, more or less, from beginning to end. And it was actually very successful, the film. It premiered at the Studio des Ursulines in Paris with a Man Ray film, as I recall. And then the film was actually reprised later in that year from October through December at Studio 28 in Paris. You would think it's every filmmaker's dream to have, a critical success, to hit a home run with your first film, but this was something, especially for Buñuel, that seemed rather upsetting, that the film is basically mocking, deriding, spoofing, lampooning bourgeois values, and people just couldn't get enough of it. So the notion that there's really nothing that's so radical that it can't be assimilated and perhaps made a little bit less radical than it was intended, this is sort of a strangely good example of that. After we see the film, I'd want to discuss a number of the motifs throughout, and we'll look at a number of Dali's works and sort of situate them. But without further ado, why don't we start the film? Oh, and I'm sorry, actually, one last thing before we start it. The music, which is always, of course, an interesting question in terms of a film. When it was first shown, the work, Buñuel had a phonograph, and he was actually playing two sorts of pieces of music to accompany the film. One is the Liebestod, the Lover's Death, from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, and the other are a pair of Argentine tangos that are incorporated. Now, that's actually a wonderfully clever sort of mix of music, if you think about it, on so many levels. For one thing, it totally goes straight to the high-low dichotomy, or whatever you want to call it, in the 20th century, which was such a part of the kind of surrealism that Dali practiced also, the notion of being an absolutely exquisite painter, but somebody was not beyond putting chromolithographs, postcards, into his paintings to sort of defy the difference between high culture and low culture. So it has this kind of high-low thing, which is wonderful about it, but probably even more significant, if you think about it, the lover's death, the notion of death coming out of the Wagner and eroticism coming out of the tangos. This is the great duality of surrealism going all the way back to the beginning and its interest in Sigmund Freud. The notion that unconscious life is largely structured along these sorts of competing principles of love and death. And these are sort of the two principles that structure the music, the tempo, basically, for the film also. So anyway, now, you know, after a false start, without further ado, why don't we watch the film? Terrific. So what I'd want to do is discuss again a number of the images and themes that you have in the film. And one of the things that's very interesting to me, I mean, Dalí, especially if you read his writings, he had a lifelong commitment to Vermeer, supposedly going back to a print that he had in his childhood home, but going all the way forward into the 1950s. Early in the film, when the young woman is sitting in the room, before you have the androgynous figure on the bicycle in the street, her attention is taken, she stands up, she throws open this book onto the table, and the print that you see is actually Vermeer's Lacemaker of Delft. And just to give you a kind of roadmap for the images also, the quotes underneath the Dalí and Buñuel images come from the Surrealist Revolution, a major organ, a major magazine of the Surrealist movement in which the scenario for the film was published. The Vermeer not only speaks to, again, this kind of lifelong interest that Dalí had in the artist, but I think is a sort of key, essentially, for the film as a whole. On the one hand, you have a superficial similarity between Vermeer and Dalí's painting style, this notion of really an exquisite form of naturalism that both of them practiced, but that was paradoxical because there was such a focus in both cases on the material reality of the world, but as a way to transcend it. One of the great things, of course, about Vermeer's pictures is the notion that they're always pregnant with some kind of possibility, strange symbolism, things that might occur. And that's very much what you have in Dalí's painting style also. He called it these images of concrete irrationality, the idea of using the material world as a way essentially to express his thoughts, his own unconscious, his feelings, but again with these material objects always being sort of a pretext towards something that's completely immaterial. If you look at the early Dalí picture, and again it's before his surrealist period, you see something of kind of a low-key tribute to a similar theme, this notion of a small-scale, intimate genre scene, the sort of thing again that Vermeer would have practiced. Now, the hallmark image, of course, throughout the entire film, and the thing that once you've seen, you can never unsee, it's a pretty unforgettable image, is the eye-slicing scene. That's actually Buñuel himself who's playing the part of the barber, which brings up one interesting issue, too. I just don't want to forget. One thing that's fascinating about the film is because it was this give and take between the two figures, who came up with which of the motifs? I mean, essentially like in motif tracing, whose idea was which? According to Buñuel, the eye-slicing idea was his own, and the ants in the hand that you have, that was something that came from Dalí. It may be true, it may not be exactly true, that it's probably the best, and the way the literature tends to focus is to really look at it as a give and take, how the images were created. So in any event, you do have Buñuel himself who's enacting this terrible sort of graphic event. And one of the things it obviously refers to, and it's a major theme of the film, and it's a major theme of Salvador Dalí's surrealist works, is psychoanalysis, the idea of blinding a figure, going back to the Oedipus story and the notion of the Oedipus complex. The Oedipus was so horrified and struck when he found out that his bride was also his mother that he famously blinded himself in the myth. And so the idea of having this blinding scene right up front, a lot like the hands that are cut off and these other kinds of acts against violence against the body, they really function in a psychoanalytic way, going back to this notion of the Oedipus complex. And in particular, something you see in a lot of Dalí's works, a kind of critique of patriarchy and traditional ideas of masculinity. One never would want to see one's own father in Dalí's father images that you have throughout the works. Now, one of the things to keep in the back of your mind, too, with An Andalusian Dog is that it was actually done before Dalí was properly part of the Surrealists. And the work that you have on the right by Dalí, it's part of the museum's collection. It's a very small painting, like so many of his Surrealist period works. And it's historically very important. It was actually one of the works that was shown in November of 1929 in Paris at a place called the Camille Gomans Gallery. And this was essentially Dali's entree into surrealism as a painter. It was one of about, I think, 8 or 10 works that he showed. André Breton, the leader of the Surrealists, had written the exhibition catalog for the Show of Pieces. And it actually has something in common. I mean, again, so The Andalusian Dog is actually in advance of his Surrealist period by a few months, if you will. But the one thing that both images really have in common is a non-narrative structure that you can also think of slicing the eye in a non-erotic sense as slicing and splicing a film. And that's actually, I think, one of the more clever interpretations of what it means. I mean, the idea of a blinding scene, putting the Oedipus stuff aside, it's such an extraordinary image to use in a visual way as opposed to a literary way. And so the idea of having the blinding scene also refers to this notion of cutting and editing film, and the whole non-narrative structure that you have for Chien Andalou. All of those intertitles are so funny because any story that you might extract from the film is completely shattered by the idea that at 3 in the morning, 16 years later, 8 years before, and in springtime, these are the sort of categories that you have for temporal experience. And that's exactly what's going on in Illumined Pleasures also, a completely non-narrative focus on dreamlike imagery. If you think about the picture as a dream, each of the shadow boxes within it represents separate vignettes within that dream. And the idea that the shadow boxes sometimes don't overlap, a break between events, sometimes one shadow box might block another one out, this is also related to the structure of dreams, non-narrative, non-linear, discontinuous. And this was one of the things that André Breton, the surrealist, loved about Dali's pictures, that even though he was moving away from surrealist automatism, automatic painting, there's nothing less automatic than Dali's painting style. He's not only capturing dream imagery, but he's organizing it in a dreamlike way, which is very smart. Again, broken, it doesn't add up to a whole that's coherent. I just wanted to show you, too, I mean, the Oedipus theme, especially for the Surrealists, it's a major theme that cuts across a number of the works. Max Ernst, not coincidentally, I mean, coming from Germany, being German-speaking, having gone to university, was one of the figures who was familiar with Sigmund Freud's writings, probably before a number of the French Surrealists, because Freud isn't being translated into French until the 20s, the later 20s, a number of his major works. And so with the Ernst work, one of the things that's so funny about it, it comes from Nature magazine, La Nature, and it was a scintillating article on something called the elasticity of a walnut. It was about how you can press open a walnut and it will bend and bend but not break. And that's essentially what you see going on with this very Monty Python-like hand that's coming through the window, pressing open the walnut. The walnut also refers to the shape of an eye that's being blinded or impaled by all of these forms. It refers to a vaginal shape as well. It has a sexual shape about it. It also refers to Saint Sebastian myths about this idea of being penetrated by all of these arrows. It's really sort of a kind of collapse of all of this very overdetermined sexualized imagery, eyes and genitalia and penetration and things of that sort, in a very kind of concise figure. And also the Giacometti. I mean, the extraordinary fragility of this incredibly phallic sort of an instrument coming straight at this face-like eye that you have at bottom. Now, also, I mean, a lot of Dali's stuff really goes to primary childhood experience. A figure that you see in a lot of his works is the figure of the wet nurse or the nursemaid. And it relates to the nurse that he actually had as a child, a woman named Lucia, whom he refers to in a lot of his writings. So the figure whom you're looking at left, and it's again a scene from the movie, it's the androgynous man or the cross-dressing man at the very beginning on the bicycle, seen from behind, it's actually referring to the figure of a wet nurse that you see throughout Dali's works. Again, so much of Dali's stuff is gender-bending in interesting ways. The idea of a figure of a wet nurse, but it's a guy who's carrying that figure, or the idea of a blinding scene going back to Oedipus, but it's a woman who's being blinded, not a guy who's being blinded. You have all of these fascinating gender inversions where traditional stories are kind of turned around in Dali's works. The figure of the wet nurse seen from behind, you see it beautifully done. If you saw the Seurat drawing show, this is almost like a veritable caricature of the figure of the governess or the nurse seen from behind with the cloth on her head and what have you. You see her also in a number of pictures that Dalí did. You see her seated on the beach. You see a night table that's been extracted from her body. And then another night table just beside it in turn, almost like, I think they're called matryoshka dolls, these sort of nested dolls, one coming out of the other. What's fascinating about that, Salvador Dalí's mother had died in 1921, and according to one of his biographers, of uterine cancer. Salvador Dalí's wife, Gala, 1931, she suffers from fibroma. I believe it's a hysterectomy that she's going to have. This conception of a maternal figure, literally his mother, or also again for Salvador Dalí, his wife, Gala, being condensed into the figure of a nursemaid, and then this kind of surgical incision into her body, and pieces of her body being removed, and pieces removed from that in turn. It really speaks a very kind of powerful, psychic, more effective sort of a relationship it has to the artist. In addition to, again, this kind of weird surgery on this maternal body, he also has a picture called The Bleeding Roses, where he takes the notion of the rose as referring to fertility and procreative potential, but it becomes this hemorrhaging, terrible mass on a woman's body, sort of replaying the same tragic theme. And on the lighter side, thank God in Dalí there's always a lighter side to things too. This is probably one of, I think it's at the Wadsworth Athenaeum, it's one of his most popular paintings, the optical illusion paintings, where you have a number of images that are condensed. If I can just move away from the microphone for 1 second and I'll come back. The figure of a hound, whom you have over here, of a fruit dish over here, and then at the base of the fruit dish, it's also a face. It's, again, the same figure of the wet nurse whom you have on the side just behind it. The idea of using the wet nurse as the figure of a mouth in a portrait, the second mother, the wet nurse, is something that's really quite ingenious on Dalí's part. And even more so is the idea of having her turned away, speaking to this notion of weaning, turning the breast away, it's no longer available to the child or what have you. I mean, again, he really did play with a lot of Freudian ideas, often in very, very clever ways. Now, the hand scene and the several hands, the severed hands that you have throughout, these also go back to Freudian notions, in particular castration anxiety, the idea for Sigmund Freud that men are so terrified at the discovery of sexual difference and that any sort of allusion to teeth falling out, decapitation is the biggest kind of metaphor for it. But any loss of bodily integrity always goes back as a threat to masculine potency. Dalí was fearless about this. You see these signs writ large throughout his works. Not just the severed hand, but also the severed hand is having kind of a double meaning for him. Again, this kind of critique of masculinity, men's bodies falling apart, speaking to weakness and vulnerability, but also speaking to sexual shame, which if you've read his writings, they're so extraordinarily confessional. And the idea of the hand and its relationship to shame in... I'm so terrible at laser pointers, I apologize. If you look at the figure that you have over here, again, it's an androgynous figure, a woman with breasts, but a kind of phallus added. It's the overwhelming presence of the hand again, and the face that's buried. And oftentimes, without the hand, you see figures in Dalí's works turned into shadow boxes, looking away, again, referring to notions of shame. The coup de grace, though, in this picture is actually the couple that you have down here at the bottom, which are two very potent critiques of masculinity. The figure who's kind of grinning like an idiot with the beard, if you look at his pants, they're besmirched. It's actually something that Dalí associates with his own father. He has this painful story to read about his father having soiled his own pants. And so the idea of representing a paternal figure, again, in such a compromised, ludicrous way, but the figure who's embracing him, right just beside, is literally blinding himself simultaneously, digging his fingers into his face, that again, another sort of critique of masculinity, this kind of Oedipal notion. The picture on the right was another one of these major pictures Dalí produced in 1929 that really signaled his entree into surrealism. And it, too, is a historically important picture because it was a subject of a feud between André Breton, the leader of the, if you want to say, conventional surrealists, if there was such a thing, and the outsider surrealists, led by another figure, Georges Bataille. And Dalí couldn't have his cake and eat it too. With this picture, he really had to decide whether he was going to toe the line with traditional surrealism or whether he was going to support outsider surrealism, because both Bataille and Breton wanted to reproduce the picture, but Breton was kind of picky and difficult and wouldn't let Bataille also do it. So Dalí had to choose, and he chose Breton. So what Bataille did that was so clever, he just made a diagram of the picture and published that instead. The hand also, I mean, as you notice, it's covered with ants, and the ants in the sort of clear way speak to notions of decay and putrefaction. And these are some of the major terms that you have in a lot of Dalí's works of the period, this notion of decay. If you look again, I mean, MoMA has just such an extraordinary collection with Dalí, among other artists, obviously, but the persistence of memory that's in the museum's collection. You see the ants in the foreground on the pocket watches, and you also see a fly gathering on another one of the pocket watches. It speaks to notions of mortality. It's a memento mori picture. Remember death. Don't forget one's mortality. So what you have is yoked to the passage of time, literally, the passage of time symbolized in these pocket watches. You have this notion of matter decaying and rotting. The ants relate to that, this notion of decay, as does the fly. The other thing, though, I think that probably isn't given enough credit in terms of the importance of ants in Dalí's works, he was obsessed with sort of a miniaturist kind of painting and poetry style. Like he has a poem called Poem of Little Things, where he just names one little thing after another. The idea of ants as being both this kind of challenge of a whole group of little individuals, but nevertheless something that you want to paint in each of their specificity. It goes this idea of plurality and multiplicity and just lots of things, and painting each one so distinctly that informs a lot of Dalí's works as well, like a challenge for the painter, essentially. And again, in one of the early works, in the bottom right-hand corner, the notion of ants gathering on the stone. This was another of the pictures Dalí showed in 1929 that Breton was so floored by. It's interesting, too, because like a lot of these works he's producing at this moment, they're a brilliant combination of collage and also painting. And it was basically to test whether you could tell where the collage stops and the painting actually begins. And more often than not, at any kind of a distance, you can't. This was something that the surrealist absolutely loved, because both collage elements, like postcards, and painting refer to two different conceptions of reality that you're bringing into one seamless whole, but that's what surrealism was for them also, the notion of bringing together like a waking and a dreaming state, for example, into a surreality. In this one, Accommodations of Desire, it's focused on the figure of the lion. The lion also has this very powerful androgynous appeal for Dalí. On the one hand, it's such an overdetermined symbol of patriarchy and masculinity, the king of the jungle. On the other hand, when he gets rid of the face so that you only have the maw, the mouth, or gets rid of the face so that the face becomes a sort of mouth itself, it also has this very genital-like presence as well. So it becomes both a very significant masculine and feminine figure. What's interesting is the idea of projecting all of these onto stones, because it goes back to another major myth in Freudian systems, the notion of the Medusa's head, of a sight that's so powerful that it turns men to stone, and that's essentially what you have with the lions. One of the major strategies that informs a lot of Dalí's career visually is something he called paranoia criticism. Paranoia was fascinating to the surrealists. There was a famous surrealist psychoanalyst, a figure named Jacques Lacan, who wrote his dissertation dealing with questions of paranoia. What was interesting for them, and especially like figures like André Breton in particular, was the notion of looking at mental illness as not being a black and white category, but looking at everything as falling along a spectrum. There's no such thing as mental health or mental unhealth. Everybody's kind of somewhere along the gamut. And some to one more direction than the other. With Dalí, with this paranoia criticism, the idea that he's playing around with is two things in the world that share a similar shape and so come to have a similar meaning, but it's simply based on morphology. It's simply based on a coincidence of shape. So in the film, for example, you see the lecherous figure who's groping the woman's breasts that then turn into thighs and buttocks and sort of go back and forth. This idea of one thing morphing into another, this is part of Dalí's paranoia criticism. Paranoia in the sense that two things in the world that don't have a causal relationship between them suddenly come into having this relationship of cause and effect. One is transformed into the other. They seem to be related. This was one of his early forays into paranoia criticism. It was a layout he did in a surrealist journal, and it started with an anthropological, an ethnographic postcard at bottom of a group of figures sitting in front of a tribal structure. And Dalí noticed if you turn it on its side and heighten the contrast, it goes from being an architectural grouping to a face. And so this is one of the early forms of paranoia criticism. Two things that have nothing in common, a group scene and the profile of somebody's face, but that come into this kind of relationship of cause and effect. And again, a number of his paranoiac-themed works dealing with the form of a bust. If you screw your eyes and then sort of unfocus your eyes, you see, like, this is the bust of Voltaire. But simultaneously, it's two women, I believe, their faces, their ruffs just behind. Bust of Voltaire, but also the eyes are made up of two women. What's interesting about paranoia criticism is it happens in time. Again, this notion of cause and effect. You can either see the bust or the two women, but you can't see both simultaneously. So there's a temporal flicker, a little bit like of a cinematic quality going back and forth. And I only mention that because Dalí had a whole other theory that was related, something called morphological echo, which is dealing with the same notion of things that are unrelated, but they have this formal similarity, and so they come to have a meaningful similarity. In the case of this work, again, Dalí is such a wonderful, you know, miniaturist. This whole painting is basically about this tic-tac-toe grid of nine objects that you have here and nine objects here. And this is a detail just to show you the nine things. What Dalí has done is he's comparing three different things going off towards the horizon that have no kind of meaningful relationship, a bunch of grapes, a reclining guy in a wall, bunch of grapes, reclining guy in a wall, but that just share this formal similarity. What's interesting is he's very cleverly used perspective so that the forms diminish in size as you go to the background, so that they all keep their same size on the surface of the canvas. So he's using two systems. He's using a grid to organize the comparison, and then perspective to keep everything within the comparison comparable in terms of scale. Again, very much like paranoia criticism, but instead of happening in time, it's all happening simultaneously in one space. And this is probably the most famous work he did dealing with this idea, although it was exactly the sort of thing that Breton started to become very critical of, that they look more like rebuses or puzzles than they do like a kind of fine art painting. The Metamorphosis of Narcissus. It's interesting because the notion of using Narcissus as the basis for a work that's about a confusion in visual imagery, right? Narcissus who confuses his reflection with the idea of another person. It was also a work that Dalí took when he met Sigmund Freud. Dalí met Freud, and Freud apparently was wild about Dalí, which is just funny because he was not at all wild about the surrealists. He made some kind of derogatory remarks about them, not understanding what they do. But I think he also said the surrealists are 90 proof, like alcohol. You just can't make heads or tails of them. So the structure over here, the figure of Narcissus, doubled as a reflection in the lake, but then also doubled as this kind of stone-like fragments that you have over here. So again, this notion within Dalí of these unrelated sorts of phenomena coming into relationship with each other by sharing a single form. It's very influential in terms of surrealism. I mean, obviously the Dalí and Buñuel image comes first, but the moment where the guy is wiping his mouth away and then the underarm hair appears, almost as sort of a goatee, this became one of the cover images for a major surrealist work by André Breton, the painting that you have by Magritte. And Magritte's idea was not all that different from Dalí's. Magritte looked at a notion called elective affinity, supposedly coming out of Goethe. But the notion of elective affinity relies on the idea of how things gain meaning by being along a chain and being associated with other things. So starting out with the idea of a face, then moving to the idea of a body, this notion of the series of metaphors based on similar shapes to gather meaning. It's very much like how Dalí would have done it earlier. And then just two last images I wanted to show from the film. one of the most extraordinary things about the film is how iconoclastic and irreverent the film is in terms of not only notions of sexuality, but notions of religion. When you look at the openness of sexuality that you have kind of traded in the film, and also the anti-Catholicism, Roman Catholicism that you have within it, it's interesting because it has so little to do with kind of contemporary Spanish painting or Spanish tradition, but so much to do with what's happening with French surrealism, critique of sexuality in the church. Dali is on the right. That was his cameo appearance, being dragged along behind the pianos and all of that. And the picture he did on the right, again, another one of these pictures from 1929, it's based on the Sacred Heart of Christ, shown as a kind of cipher form, but he's also identifying himself with the figure of Christ within it. He's identifying his own mother, who had passed away earlier in the decade, with the Mother Church, with the Virgin Mary. The work is interesting on two levels. One is that, again, as the story goes from his biographers, it got him exiled from his family home. His father was nonplussed, not so much about the critique of religion, but the notion of bringing your mother and spit, your passed away mother and spit, into the same sentence. So Dali actually had a row with his father concerning this work in particular. The other thing, though, that's interesting about it, a theme that cuts through a lot of Dali's works, is kind of a messianic complex, an identification with Christ, that a clever one, not like a, you know, off the charts one. His name being Salvador. His father was also Salvador, but so was his older brother who died in infancy. And so the idea of an infant Salvador dying and resurrecting as another Salvador is a theme that you see throughout a number of his pictures. Dali's self-portrait spitting into a Eucharist cup. Again, this kind of irreverent, iconoclastic nature. And then just this last image. The haunting donkeys, rotting donkeys on the piano, and Dali helped them along their way to rotting. He really wanted to emphasize that gouging out their eyes, gouging out their gums, so that the teeth were visible, and that the teeth become a sort of metaphor for the piano keys, which is clever, the ivories and the enamel. But you also see, again, so many of the works, themes in the movie coming out in his paintings. He had a whole series of pictures on the notion of William Tell, who was a fascinating legend for him, because the idea of a father shooting an apple off his son's head in Dali's head takes on all of these other connotations that aren't traditionally thought of. So it's a picture, part of the William Tell series, but if you look at what's going on up here, it's a pianist with a rotting donkey right on top of the piano. It's very clever. On the one hand, he's playing a lot of word games in this film. In French, a grand piano is a piano with a tail, or a piano with a slang for penis or what have you, that has this very kind of sexual quality for him. And in fact, if you read his writings as well, Dali speaks of this traumatic moment as a kid when his father had left a book, a kind of warning book on venereal disease on a piano in the family home. So rotting, putrescence, sexuality, and this kind of tie between a sexual piano and sort of a venereal donkey that you have on top. And this is the last thing, I guess. This is one of the strangest things about Dali. It's not so much the meaning of these things, but it's the sort of inaccessibility of the meaning of these things, that there's not really anything like a shared symbolism or common iconography going on within his works. Like, I know that St. Lucy, she's holding an eyeball or something like that. That so much of the meaning of these works comes out of his very, very extensive writings, and often writings that, as a reader, I mean, you know, having read a number of them, you feel invasive, frankly, that you're somehow coming into this very intimate contact with him. But then that goes back to his notion of concrete images of irrationality, making his images accessible to the rest of the world, bring you into that kind of an intimate relationship. So I've long overstepped my time, so I'd like to thank you very much. If you have any questions, thank you. Feel free just to come up afterwards and enjoy the museum. Enjoy the beautiful day.